And here we go. His year again. Rory is a rare repeat winner at Augusta.
From wondering if he would ever win the Masters and thus complete the career Grand Slam, to joining another elite group of Masters champions, Rory McIlroy has enjoyed a remarkable 2 years at golf's most prestigious event. With thanks to CBS Sports for the audio, Kelly Elbin welcoming you to a special episode here on Musings on Golf as we recap the 90th playing of the Masters. Janice Self, our executive producer, is alongside once again, and you will hear shortly from one of the country's great golf writers, Bill Fields, who just covered his 41st Masters and whose terrific new book, A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf, is now out. I tell you, we talked to Bill earlier today. Great insights about this particular Masters and about what is really a very poignant book that includes, among others, a neat story about a very young Tiger Woods and frankly, chapters that go outside the sphere of golf. Just a fantastic read. Before I get into Rory in particular, I personally had a really different and altogether refreshing perspective on the Masters this year. My brother Max and I, thanks to our sister Karine, very lucky to attend the Masters tournament over the 4 days. I hadn't been there, I think, in a decade. Janice and Bob Bupka worked the Masters many years, but I'd been away for a while, and it kind of like being reborn again in a strange way. There's just something mystical. There's, you know, you see it on TV, and you understand the familiarity with the holes. You know them all. My brother and I, for example, we went down on Saturday morning to Amen Corner before all of the craziness ensued. And just to stand there and think about, you know, this is where the greats of the game have played and key shots have been hit over the years, so much history made, and just to kind of soak it all in. It is a unique event. And Bill and I get into it quite a bit with the no cell phones and the no corporate sponsors. And it's, you're there, and Rory McIlroy even talks about that the patrons are in the moment. You're present. You're not on a cell phone. You're not focused on anything else other than being there for a golf tournament. And Rory also said, look, at the end of what was really an unusually hot few days in Augusta, Georgia, he admitted how hard it is to win the Masters. I mean, there was so much pressure on him last year that when he finally got it done and reached the summit. But he was very honest. I mean, you had Justin Rose down the stretch and Scottie Scheffler, who ended up a shot back, and he's playing alongside Cameron Young, who just couldn't quite get it done. Hopefully he does one day. But a lot of it turned in that sort of before the midpoint of the round, hole six, both of them made bogey, Heath McIlroy and Cam, and then Cam Young made a bad bogey at seven. Rory birdied seven and eight, and then went on to play the rest of the way and, three under par, getting a great break on the final hole. Knew he needed to make double bogey, needed to make no worse than a bogey, and that's exactly what he made. So he goes out and shoots a tournament record, 12 under par over the first 2 days. And let's hear what he has to say about how he felt he needed to play over the last two rounds to secure that second victory.
I don't think I would have believed anyone if they said to me, you know, all you have to do is shoot even par for the weekend and you'll win. I definitely thought I was going to need to go out there and at least shoot a couple of under par scores. But, you know, the course in the afternoon, you know, yesterday the course was gettable pretty much all day. But today the wind was up a little bit. It was gusty. It made things definitely a little more tricky, especially on the back nine. And I just had to hang in there. You know, I did a decent range session last night and tried to figure a couple of things out. And I definitely hit my irons better today. I think I struck the ball better today overall, which was good to see. But I still needed to rely on my short game those last few holes. You know, the up and down on 16 and the up and down on 17 were huge. But yeah, just absolutely delighted to be able to get it done. You know, having a six-shot lead going into the weekend, it would have been a bitter pill to swallow if I wasn't able to get myself over the finish line.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It would have been quite the bitter pill, and a lot would have been brought up about him not being able to close once again. But he got it done, and it's ironic, as he said, that he felt like he needed to go a lot lower over the weekend, but he finished exactly the way he started on Saturday morning at 12 under par. So Rory joins Jack Nicklaus, Nick Faldo, and Tiger Woods as now the fourth to win the Masters twice, and nobody's ever done it three times, and there's certainly motivation to do that. And I also think there's motivation. He talked a lot about, as I sort of referred to, reaching the summit of you know, finishing off the career Grand Slam last year, and kind of the balloon went out a little bit. Not so much this time. He talked quite a bit at his press conference afterward, and at the presentation, I hung around and watched the outdoor presentation, which really was a cool deal. And about being hungrier and being more focused. And now the PGA of America can't be any more thrilled with having the PGA Championship in a month at Adirondack Golf Club outside of Philadelphia with a hungry Rory McIlroy coming in. And he, if he doesn't win the PGA Championship, that's one thing. But if he were to win the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills on Long Island in June, and if he were to win the Open Championship in July at Royal Birkdale in Southport, England, then he becomes only the third player ever to win career Grand Slam twice. The other two being, obviously, Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods, who did it three times. Bill also, Bill Fields, in addition to talking about his book, he talks about Scottie Scheffler and the slow start he has. He talked about the resiliency of Justin Rose, and he talks about Cameron Young. I've gotten to know, I've mentioned this before, I've gotten to know David Young, Cameron's father, and I saw David Young on Thursday when his son was three over par playing the sixth hole, and all he said real quick as he passed was, you know, got a long way to go. And sure enough, his boy hung in there, slow start and all. I think Cam Young will look back at this as really good experience. The really crusty, tough conditions out there with no rain, it'll serve him well in the long run. Interestingly enough, the top four players in the world all finished among the top four. And going back again real quick to the time I spent with my brother, it was really cool. I've mentioned several times that our dad, Max Selbin, was on the rules committee for the Masters for 25 years. So certainly thought about my dad while I was there. Just honored and privileged to go. But I will say this, I don't need to go back. I'm good. I've kind of ticked it off my bucket list only because you simply see everything on TV and it's a hard walk. And the drama that plays out, you frankly see it on TV much more than you do in person. It was great to be there. I'm glad I did it. If I could help somebody get more tickets to the toughest ticket in golf, I would get more satisfaction out of that, to be quite honest with you, than going again. But a few things we also noticed, by the way, in addition to the no cell phones, it's pretty hard to actually see any birds, by the way. You do hear some birds. You do. But you got to look really hard to actually see any birds. So how much CBS Sports might be piping in bird sounds? I think there's something to that, because you don't see a lot of birds flying around. You don't see any squirrels. You don't see any rabbits. You don't see any bees. You don't see any flies. It's the most amazing place that you'll ever see, with 40,000 people gathering there every day. All right. Bill Fields, again, I've known Bill a long time. I didn't really understand until we started talking, when we hooked up at early morning on Thursday at the Masters, that Bill was a photographer as well as an outstanding writer. So that was his introduction to the Masters as a photographer in 1985. You're really going to enjoy these stories from Bill Fields, and you'll hear those right after these messages from William and Harry and the Friars Golf Club. And remember to subscribe to Musings on Golf. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Kelly Elbin here, and you're hearing this first on Musings on Golf. William and Harry Golf is unveiling the brand new Spring Championship Collection and we're so very proud to be the first to announce it. Two stunning shoes, the Champion's Walk and the Azalea, one designed for men and one for women, built on the same design nominated by Golf Digest as one of the best golf shoes of 2025 and quite possibly the most comfortable golf shoe in the world today. Inspired by the colors of golf's most iconic spring championship, greens, yellows, and the beautiful pink bloom of spring in the South. And I'll tell you this, these may be, in fact, the most comfortable and the most beautiful golf shoes created in 2026. The Spring Championship Collection officially begins today, so be sure to visit williamandharry.com to learn more about this exciting new collection. William & Harry Golf, spring has finally arrived, and it's all about William & Harry Golf. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work, planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. Great storytelling is at the heart of our special guest today as we welcome him in to help us recap the 2026 Masters and discuss his wonderful new book, Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf. He is the recipient of the 2020 PGA of America Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. For 20 years, he was the senior editor of Golf World Magazine, 40-plus years as a sports writer. Boy, is he extremely proud of his roots, having been born in Pinehurst, North Carolina, raised in nearby Southern Pines. Oh, and did I mention, he's just finished covering his 41st Masters. What a pleasure to welcome Bill Fields to Musings on Golf. Mr. Fields, so good to have you with us.
Mr. Kelly, making me feel old. Thank you. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, you know, before we get to the questions, and we mentioned this before we started, just by coincidence, we happened to run into one another by the big tree, just off from the first hole at Augusta National on Thursday morning. It was really cool to see you. And Bill, your 41st Masters, maybe let me step back a second. What was your very first Masters? What year? And in what capacity? And what was that like for a kid at that time to be covering the Masters?
Yeah, first Masters was 1985, Bernard Langer, when he won dressed like a Twizzler on Sunday, head to toe red. That was it. And I was a photographer, my first 10 or so Masters were credentialed as a photographer. So I've seen it from that role and then for more of the years as a reporter.
Yeah, and I've known you really as just as a reporter, but photography indeed has been a huge part of your life. You went to North Carolina, University of North Carolina. I know you're a very proud Tar Heel. Did you refine your photography interest there? Where did that start?
No, really. Back in the 70s and 80s, whoever got the associate editor job at Golf World magazine, which was then based in Southern Pines, they sort of said, okay, you're right, but you got to learn to take tournament golf pictures too. And it was kind of a learned by doing. You know, obviously tried to look at all the good photography I could. I had friends that helped me. But yeah, being at the 85 Masters, that would have been the second men's major that I shot. I shot the Women's Open in 84 and the PGA in Shoal Creek in 84. But then the Masters, the first one was 85.
What did you think when you walked on the grounds for the first time to work a Masters?
Well, I'd only been there once as a spectator in 1982 on a really rainy day, so it wasn't a premium experience. So it really was my first time, and just, you know, common impressions, the expanse of the place, the elevation change, and the beauty. There's really, for that type of manicured look with the flowers in bloom, the ornamentals, just, it's a stunning place.
It really is. My brother Max and I spent 4 days there this past weekend at Augusta. First time, Bill, I had been back in maybe 10 years, as I mentioned to you before we started. And there's just a magical quality about that place, particularly as a patron as you attend. We'll get to that in a little bit. We're going to certainly talk more in detail about A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf, your new book out. But yours is a new book. Rory has obviously authored another chapter in history, becoming just the fourth player, joining Faldo, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger as the only ones now to win back-to-back Masters. Bill, and he even said this post-game, and I think in the presentation ceremony, after so many years of trying and all of the hardships that he endured, some of them self-inflicted, now he's completed the Grand Slam in 1 year, and the next year he's tied with Nick Faldo for the most titles, major championship titles, among Europeans with six. It's really and truly, Bill Fields, been a remarkable two Masters for Rory McIlroy.
It sure has, Kelly. What a fantastic scene it was last year when he completed the career Grand Slam, dropped to his knees. A totally emotional moment. This year was not that emotional, but it had to be just, almost as satisfying for him to do what, as you said, only three great players had done before. It not easy to repeat, clearly, the year after winning. And he again, he made big history last year. He makes some more little history, at least this year, in joining that select group.
Hey, Bill, what struck you in terms of how he went about this win? He sets the 36-hole record. He's 12 under. He has a six-shot lead, and poof, that's gone after the third round. And it's a full battle on with a number of other guys who legitimately had chances, but he prevailed. What impressed you about Rory on that on Sunday?
Well, I think he really did go to the range by himself on Saturday evening and worked out some things. I believe it was a matter of trying to get his legs a little more active on the downswing. He'd missed some shots to the left on Saturday as he let that huge lead, the largest in Masters history after 36 holes, he let it get away. And I guess just as an observer, I wasn't super confident that he was going to pull it off on Sunday, but especially after he made it, made an early double bogey on four, made kind of a sloppy bogey on six, but then he birdied 7 and 8, and then the Amen Corner performance on 12 and 13. That's really where he cemented it. He gave himself a scare on 18. That was a terrible tee shot, and he got lucky. That
Yes.
ball could have been stymied. It was he had a clear swing to get it up near the green. He had some good fortune there.
Bill, the look on his face as he was walking up from the tee, anxiously looking to see where that ball was, that had to be the first time in many holes, over those 72 holes where he was truly concerned.
It could have been really bad. I mean, he could have had to. He could have been stunned. He could have had to take an unplayable. He could have had to just chip out. It's a bogey still was certainly in the cards, which is all he needed, thanks to his great par saves on 16 and 17. Those were huge. His short game was magical most of the tournament, and that is something that can carry a player a long way.
It is. He played, I believe he played the par fives in 10 under par, as opposed to Scottie Scheffler, who played the par fives in 5 under par. I wonder if you could maybe give a few thoughts on Scheffler, who was indeed 12 back at the midpoint and was able to shave 11 shots off, but of course finished a shot back. Give some thoughts on Scheffler of what you saw, as well as two other guys, Justin Rose, who just can't seem to get over the finish line. And Cameron Young, his first time really with a lead on, at some point Sunday in a major championship. How about some thoughts on those three guys?
Well, Scheffler's MO in 2026 on the tour, almost every tournament, was a very slow start in the first round, and he would have to dig out of the hole. And sure enough, at this Masters, which he won in 22 and 24, he was trying to sort of do what Arnold did years ago, win the Masters every 2 years, which is not a bad model to copy either.
Yeah,
But
right.
Scotty really dug a big hole. If he had come back and won, it would have been by far the largest comeback after 36. Jack Burke Jr. was eight back in 1956 and remained eight back after 54 that year. Scotty, he went the last two rounds bogey free, and according to the records going back to 1942, he's the first player to do that, to play the weekend bogey free. So that's certainly commendable, but yet down the stretch he just could not make enough birdies to continue is what was a fine charge to try to win a third green jacket. As for Cameron Young, the player's victory where he really was clutch down the stretch had to be a big help for him from a confidence standpoint. He said this week, last week at Augusta, that he kind of looked at it as prep for the Masters, because as big a tournament as the Players is, he wants to win a major. He had had a taste of coming close all the way back to when he was a PGA Tour rookie in 22 at the Old Course, where he closed with a great final round, eagled the last hole, and ended up finishing second to Cameron Smith. But this major, he was right in the mix, paired with Rory, last group. I called Jerry Haas, his coach at Wake Forest, this weekend, just to get a little background. Jerry put it very well. He said, "Look, he's not the kind of guy who's going to walk in a room and say, 'Look at me.' He's clearly a guy, much like Scheffler, who just impresses by what he does." And he came up short. He parred last 9 holes. So that wasn't enough to get it done. But he'll be back very soon, I think. Justin Rose, how commendable. Age 45. 45 now seems a lot younger than it did when Jack won at 46, 40
Yeah,
years
good point.
ago. Rose, clearly very fit. Travels with a trailer with the ice plunge and the whole thing. Things are much different now for these elite golfers than they were many years ago. But he was in the mix again, and unlike Rory though, at Amen Corner, Rose found trouble, and that ended up being what dropped him down.
Hey, Bill, it always impresses me with Justin Rose, and I think this is an admirable trait of a lot of guys, is the resiliency and that ability somehow to, I guess it's to compartmentalize, Bill Fields, and put what happened in the past and move forward. And I would think that Justin Rose will play well in the other major championships this year, and he'll contend or at least play well at the Masters next year.
Certainly wouldn't be surprised if he does. Extremely fit, appears extremely motivated. Remember, he showed a picture of his office at home, I believe, and he had a big trophy display area, and he had an open receptacle for another trophy. And I know he would love for that to be, a second major. He had that great U.S. Open victory at Marion, but yeah, just very impressive. And I think, in an era where people in their 40s have not really dominated or played so well as they did in the VGA era back in the 2000s. He's really a bit of an outlier right now.
Bill Fields with us here on Music Zone Golf. His new book, A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf, is out, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Bill, I do want to mention, I know the PGA of America has to feel as if it's a huge beneficiary of Rory coming in, having won the Masters, and next month with the PGA Championship at Ronnemann Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. Bill, I think it was different last year, and I think Rory's even mentioned it. Look, he hit the mountaintop last year. He finally not only won the Masters, but the career Grand Slam. Bill Fields, he seems a lot hungrier now. Now it's about, let's win more of these darn things, right? And let's look at maybe winning the Grand Slam twice, the career Grand Slam twice. It sure seems and sounds like a very different mentality and approach after this win.
Well, yes, and how could it not be, given that the drought between winning the 2014 PGA and the 25 Masters, nearly 11 years, and no one would have predicted that. The man had won the four majors very quickly. He'd won a couple of them, by a lot of strokes. He was a young man, on the upswing, and then the major drought just sort of began. And it's worth remembering that. There's no guarantee that players that win a handful or so majors, they're going to keep winning. I mean, a number of players, Watson, Ballesteros, they stopped winning Palmer, they stopped winning majors in their early 30s. It happens. It shows how hard it is to accomplish that. And my goodness, I would think Rory had a lot of nights where he had some very good red wine last spring, and just enjoyed the heck out of what he had achieved. And why not? This year, it was an encore, a successful encore, and hey, he's become the face of golf in the period after post Tiger Woods. Scotty's been great, but I think with what Rory achieved last year, now this, Rory is kind of the face of men's golf right now.
Agreed. One more Masters question on a larger scale, Bill, before we get into the book. As I mentioned, my brother and I were there, and there's just there's it's the Masters. There's something that's so special about it. It had been about 10 years since I had been there. And one of the coolest things that I'm glad we did was to go down to Amen Corner on Saturday morning. before it got crazy and the crowds filled up. Of course, the chairs had already been placed there, just as they had already been placed around 9 green and 18 green and would be touched until people came back. But Bill, just to soak it in, there's no question it's a spiritual thing for us golfers. It's a cathedral. How do you go about in the written word or in speaking to talk about that place?
Well, you don't want to go overboard in terms of, you know, if you're a professional, you don't want to go overboard. You acknowledge that it is this special place with the beauty and the distinct characteristics that you mentioned. You know, there's not corporate signage everywhere out in the playing area. It is a clean look. The lack of cell phones is huge, I think.
I agree.
It's just amazing when you go to a week-to-week tour event or to the players or now to U.S. Open, PGA, Open Championship, they all allow phones. And I'm not saying that's bad, but, you know, it probably is in line with where our society is now, even though everybody would probably do well to put their phone down more than they do. But it's Rory referred to it, the fans are present. And there's an appeal to that. And, you know, I don't see the Masters changing that policy. I really think they're going to stick with it because, it's tried and true and it works and it contributes to what you observed is just a very clean look, a very different look compared to a lot of corporate intrusion into professional sports now, whether it's, digital ads on basketball courts or you know, whatever, or behind the catcher in baseball, whatever it might be. Things have moved in that direction. That's not changing, but I don't think the Masters is changing either in the way it does things.
Bill, I was in line a couple of mornings at about, Thursday morning at about 6 a.m. And even earlier on Sunday morning. I have never seen a happier group of people without phones, conversing, getting to know one another, just quietly waiting. Obviously, they're going into the Masters, but I agree with you on the cell phone policy. It has so many positive ramifications for why we, particularly from an in-person perspective, love the Masters.
It's kind of ironic because I went to my first Masters, in the mid-80s. It was a big deal then. It's always been a big deal. But the advent of social media, there seems to be a lot more people, including young people, that they're obsessed with the Masters. They're obsessed with all the details, and much more so than I was as a young person. It was a great tournament. You like to be there working, but it just sort of has picked up this kind of crescendo of attention in the social media era that I found interesting, and like you say, it's managed to keep its identity in terms of how the presentation is, but. You know, it's certainly taken a little bit different vibe, I think.
Yeah, Bill, I agree with you in terms of the obsession that so many people have for the Masters and how it's just continued to grow through the years. I tell you what, let's take a brief time out and hear what Coach Urban Meyer has to say about William and Harry and their fantastic golf shoes.
As a coach, I've always believed the little details matter, preparation and discipline. Having the right equipment, that's why I wear William & Harry golf shoes. They're the most comfortable and classy shoes on and off the course. You'll appreciate the difference. William & Harry golf shoes, comfort, class, and championship standards.
Kelly Elbin here, and you're hearing this first on Musings on Golf. William & Harry Golf is unveiling the brand new Spring Championship Collection, and we're so very proud to be the first to announce it. Two stunning shoes, the Champions Walk and the Azalea, one designed for men and one for women, built on the same design nominated by Golf Digest as one of the best golf shoes of 2025 and quite possibly the most comfortable golf shoe in the world today. Inspired by the colors of golf's most iconic spring championship, greens, yellows, and the beautiful pink bloom of spring in the South. And I'll tell you this, these may be, in fact, the most comfortable and the most beautiful golf shoes created in 2026. The Spring Championship Collection officially begins today, so be sure to visit williamandharry.com to learn more about this exciting new collection. William & Harry Golf, spring has finally arrived, and it's all about William & Harry Golf. Hey, let's talk about your book. I've had an opportunity to read a few chapters. A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf. All right, very first thing, A Quick Nine Before Dark. Why the title?
Well, I thought it was a evocative phrase. I thought it speaks to so much of the early part of the book. My growing up, being obsessed with golf, playing all the golf I could, particularly often late in the day after, you know, whether it was practicing on the high school team at Pinehurst Number One course, or the summers that I was fortunate to work at Mid Pines as a cart guy, and would, you know, wait for the last guy to come in, put the carts in, and then I was out to join the assistant pros. I mean, it was really, you know, idyllic doesn't begin to describe it for a kid who was totally in love with golf.
So did that start with your parents? Did you have a club in your hand early as in life?
No, I think what some people might find interesting about my memoir is that it was the other way around with my father. I introduced him to golf rather than the other way around, and which you know, he was not of a golf family. He had some snags in life, but you know, I got into golf as a kid, perhaps by osmosis, living where I did with so much golf around me. I was a sports mad kid. I loved the other sports too. Eventually focused on golf, but to getting my dad into the game, and I write about this a lot in the memoir, it was a real pleasure to see him, you know, get the pleasure out of the game that he got for about 10 years before he passed away pretty young at, you know, age 59. But he, that last decade of his life, he got a lot. He wasn't a textbook golfer. He didn't hit a wood off the tee because he sliced it. He played with a 2-iron off the tee. You know, but he had a heck of a lot of fun, and I think people will relate to that.
Right, and those were great times for you and your dad to be together, right?
They were. We had fished a lot together in farm ponds and what have you for years as when I was a kid. Those were great outings, but the golf was special too. He played a lot with his friends that he made without me, but we did play a fair amount, and he enjoyed it, and it was a. Looking back on it all these many years later, I really do take satisfaction and joy in having done that for his life.
Absolutely. How do you go about describing the book? If someone asks you, Bill, I love the title. What's this book about? What's your answer to that?
Well, initially, it was just going to be A Quick Nine Before Dark and just a memoir, which memoirs often are categorized that way. But my publisher, Chris Solovic of Tatra Press, he just felt that, you know, Life in Golf as a subtitle would be perhaps more effective from a sales standpoint. And I was okay with that. But I do think that people will take away more than just, there is a lot of golf. There's a lot of golf media. There's a lot of golf, period, in the book. But there's also some coming of age stuff. There's the family stuff that I mentioned. I had a really nice email from someone who, a little bit older than me, grew up in the Northeast, obviously became a much better golfer than me. He played the tour for a number of years before moving on to different path in life. But he sent me an email right after finishing the book, and he said, gosh, I really enjoyed it. I felt like I was reliving my life. Just I think because some of the pictures I painted of that 1970s period, just the way golf was and the way life was, I hope people can relate to that.
Yeah, you used the term idyllic, and you meant it, right? It was a wonderful way to grow up.
It really was. I often sometimes have referred to Southern Pines Pinehurst of my youth as a sort of a sophisticated Mayberry. You know, I was a big fan of Andy Griffith's show, but, you know, that was a typical small town. This Southern Pines Pinehurst always had an influx of people from the north, whether they had come here to retire or whether they had come here to work at resorts in the fall through spring. And then they went back up north to work at on Fire Island or Nantucket or, you know, somewhere up north. It was just always a nice mix of people from different backgrounds. And that certainly enriched my childhood.
Bill, what's the story about you being a standard bearer?
Oh, yeah. A lot of fun doing that at the it was the World Open. It was a tour event in Pinehurst it was called the World Open from 73 through 76. And I attended 73 as a spectator. And that might have been the last tournament I paid to get in because I was a volunteer standard bearer for the next 3 years. It was held in September. My high school golf buddies and I would become, guys in the green jumpsuits carrying the scoring standard. And, you know, that was just so, if we were so into golf and we were so dreaming of doing that one day ourselves, that to get to be that close to the players was such a treat. I described being on a tee, and you know, you're right there crouching down, you know, and there's a, you know, Tom Watson jingling his irons to decide what club to hit on the sixth hole of number two, the par three. I mean, it just, it was very cool and you know, vivid. I'm fortunate to have a good memory of those days, but those things certainly are very clear in my mind.
Yeah, and you were what, 14, 15, 16 years old, right?
Exactly. Yeah, high school student. Yeah.
How good a player were you, Bill? I know you played in your golf team. How good?
I think I probably got to a four or five-ish handicap, yeah, at my best. I listened to too many people. I certainly tried hard. I had some good hand-eye coordination, but I just, you know, I write about it in the book. My golf career might be epitomized by the second round of the state high school tournament in 1975. I went 52-36. So that will not get you a college golf scholarship or on the tour, but
that kind of sums it up in a sweet way, right?
I've had that imprinted on a couple of ball markers just for fun. It might still be a state record. I don't know.
52-36, a quick nine before dark. A Life in Golf is the book that's just out. Bill Fields is the author. Bill, Tiger is, I believe, the first chapter. A Very Young Tiger is the very first chapter of the book. You talk a little bit about that without giving too much away, but it really was. This was in his formative years.
Yeah, I thought that was a good way to kind of hook people. Okay, this guy's, you know, he's been around. He's experienced some you know, big league golf, and you know, he's been up close to some people. I thought it was a good way to get into the book, and you know, he was 15 years old. He had just won his first U.S. Junior Amateur. He was just, you know, he'd obviously been known in Southern California, but he was just kind of becoming known nationally. And yeah, spent a day with him out in Southern California for a profile for Golf Magazine. And it was really cool to see him, especially given what, you know, okay, people knew he was going to be good, but people probably couldn't have predicted that, you know, 15 majors and 82 wins and the whole ball of wax.
All right. Who would know? Some other chapters of the book that you might give a little preview of that really stand out that are favorites of yours?
Well, I think from a non-golf standpoint, the chapter I write about going to school in Chapel Hill, going to college there, I think, you know, my experiences were as a you know, a student journalist who was totally immersed in writing for the school paper. You know, eventually became sports editor of the Daily Tar Heel, and you know, over the many decades, a lot of people that went on to have really good careers had spent time at the Daily Tar Heel, and you know, that was a great experience. But just some other coming of age things, you know, from that period, outside of golf and outside of journalism, I think people will you know, smile about in some cases and say, "Hey, that was me."
Exactly, Bill. You covered a lot of important golf tournaments and events through your years, particularly with Golf World. Any one or two stand out for their significance, whether it might have been, I don't know, Jack winning in 86 at the Masters, something along those lines?
Well, that was the second Masters that I photographed, the 86 one. And yeah. I have a photograph taken by my longtime friend and colleague, Stephen Zerley, who was a fantastic photographer for many years. And he had back then there was a camera tower behind the 18th, and a few people would get to place remote cameras there. And Steve took a shot of Jack right after he had won, arms up in the air, son Jackie nearby, and I'm in the front row. I'd held my position earlier in the day to get on the ground and shoot. And sure enough, you can just see my then very dark hair and my arm and a green visor, and I'm there. I'm in the scene. And, you know, of course, I had my own photographs from that moment, but to be in that scene, I really like that photograph. It really takes me back. And that was certainly a very memorable afternoon. It was so unexpected. And the way all the pieces fell into place for Jack, with so many great players from another later era right in the mix, and they all just couldn't quite get it done. And Jack did. Fantastic afternoon.
Did you have a favorite player from that era? Was it Jack or was it somebody else?
You know, I think, I don't know about favorite, but of course, I mean, I loved it when Watson came along and they had their duels. I write about, you know, I was a sports writer in Athens, Georgia in 82 when Watson, you know, hold the chip and beat Jack at Pebble Beach. But I was covering a local youth soccer tournament that afternoon, and I did not do my best covering the soccer because I was slipping away to a Sears to look at the TV to see what was going on. You know, it was a great, there were some great moments in that period. And, you know, years later, I got to fly with Palmer for a few days as he was about to turn 60 years old. What a fun experience that was, getting to, you know, fly probably 6 to 8 legs of flights with him flying. You know, that was a whole, and including one of those trips was into the Moore County Airport near Pinehurst, where he was designing a course with his longtime design partner, Ed Say. So getting able to fly in on a, you know, on that Citation jet with Palmer and company was a thrill.
You have an extra a story from that? I mean, to be able to spend that time with Mr. Palmer, that any particular remembrance?
Well, I remember it was he went to St. Louis to promote an upcoming course I think he was doing, and the schedule was a little off, and he had a few hours to kill before the ceremony that evening. And I remember he went and got a manicure, which I
mean,
you know, I mean, yeah, why not, right? But I found that, you know, I don't know that I'd seen or heard of a man getting a manicure before that. That would have been in 1989.
I would imagine he treated you the same as he treated people throughout his life, right? He was just a great guy to be around.
Yeah, he was very, very cordial. And his wife, Winnie, was on that trip as well. And I remember it was later that day of the manicure that, you know, Winnie had told me, grab a couple of sliders sandwiches so Arnold can have something to eat. So I helped Arnold get his dinner that night after a busy banquet or whatever. So that was cool. But, you know, one other time I remember interviewing Arnold, it was in 98 when I was doing a big story about the, 66 U.S. Open at Olympic Club. And of course that was the one where he blew the big lead to lose to Billy Casper. And, you know, it wasn't his favorite topic, but, and so I remember, I think it was a parking lot somewhere. He was at his car, like as he would do, regripping his grips by hand. You know, he did that all the time. And he would much rather been talking about anything, but he did give me enough to help the story. But yeah, what a gracious guy over many years to many people.
Bill, we always close these interviews with the same question of, you know, kind of a dream foursome. Who would round out, you know, three others who you'd play with to round out a foursome, whether they're still with us or deceased, and where would you go teed up with them? And why would you go to that particular place?
Well, I'm going to bring my three players to Mid Pines, which is where I had so many great times, and which is now, you know, been restored some years back by Kyle Franz. I thought you did a great job. And I'm going to go with Sam Snead, young Tom Morris, and Nicky Wright, hoping that some of their talent would rub off. I think, you know, some people don't appreciate like what a young Tom Morris did in the 1900s, having played a little bit of Hickory golf. My contention is that players of great talent of those years, they could definitely figure out a way to hit a 460cc driver. The current guys may be able to do it too, but, you know, it's not as much of a slam dunk.
And why Mickey Wright? Tell us more about what made her special as a just an incredible talent.
Well, I never saw her play in person. I probably saw a couple of clips on TV, you know, in her prime. She retired early, much like Byron Nelson. But, you know, I did have a bit of a phone or email relationship with her in her later years, not as much as some other writers, but I was in touch with her occasionally. Like others, I always tried to get an audience in person, but she was very private. She wasn't reclusive, but she had done her thing. She had poured her heart into not only her game, but the fate of the LPGA Tour, as so many players of that era did. They really put their heart and soul into the mechanics of the tour. They had to. But just a fantastic fantastic golf swing, as you know, Ben Hogan raved about it. It would just be a lot of fun to experience that. And I did play with Sam Snead once. I write about it in the book when he was 84 years old, and that was a treat. So if a Sam in his prime could come back, my goodness, how fun would that be? That man looked like he was born to swing a club, the way his arms hang, the club, and just the rhythm. It's just beautiful.
Well, he's just a great athlete. I mean, the things he could do, kicking, kind of like Gary does now with kicking his leg up high.
Yep. And you know, people say God-given or whatever, but I mean, my goodness, any great player practices a ton, and Sam certainly did, and worked on his fitness, didn't drink much in his prime, didn't smoke. But as I write about in the book, when the after our round of golf, we went back to his place in Florida, and we had a couple of tall, very tall rum and cokes. So Sam relaxed a little bit in his later years.
Talk about a great storyteller, right?
Yeah. And he had, he was still sharp. You know, I think in his last couple of years, you know, he died in 2002. I remember writing our major obituary for Golf World, which was a, you know, it was a, an honor, I guess, a player of that stature to try to put him in some perspective. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun to play with him and spend some time hearing some stories for sure.
Bill, as we close, actually one more question. What's your hope that people come out of this book once they purchase it, A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf? What do you want them to emerge from after reading the book?
Well, I hope they appreciate the writing. I've taken pride in how I put words together over the years, and fortunately, my work has been well received. But this is a personal story, and I hope the stories that people have enjoyed over the years that I've written about many aspects of the game, I hope they enjoy reading this one where I put my own life, or try to, in perspective. That would be my hope, I think.
Bill, for our listeners, where can they purchase A Quick Nine Before Dark? Whether online or in a bookstore, where's the book available?
Well, I know there are some brick and mortar places that have it. I noticed the number of the Barnes and Nobles in North Carolina have it in stock, which is nice. The Country Bookshop here in Southern Pines. I signed a bunch of books there this morning for them. Great independent shop, but online you can get it. Amazon, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org, which is a site that I really like that you can. You can sort of peg your local independent store and they get a cut. You know, it's available all those places. And I hope people check it out. I'm proud of it. I think, you know, if you like golf, but even if you don't like golf, I think it's a good story.
Bill Fields, I'm so pleased we saw one another on day one of the Masters. So pleased we could get together for this. And I strongly encourage our listeners to get out and purchase A Quick Nine Before Dark, A Life in Golf. Bill, always enjoyed our time together. Best of luck moving forward, and best of luck moving forward with this book, my friend.
Thanks, Kelly. And I do have a website for the book called aquick9beforedark.com. So viewers can link to all the sites to buy the book there, and they also can get some further descriptions and some reviews that have been written. So that's a good place for people to check it out, aquick9beforedark.com.
Beautiful. Bill Fields, so great to be with you. Wishing you all the best.
Thanks so much, Kelly. Really enjoyed our chat.
Well, we thank Bill Fields. That was absolutely terrific. Bill, 41 years covering the Masters, and hope you all enjoyed that. And please consider going out and buying Bill's new book. Hope everyone had a great Masters. I know Rory McIlroy certainly did, joining an elite group of major winners. Kelly Elbin, on behalf of Janice Self, signing off special episode of Masters 2026 on Musings on Golf.